This is the second period of day three of the 1989 Idlewild Bible School. Our second period speaker is Brother Frank Abel, and his general subject is Haggai. His subtopic for today's class is The Silver is Mine and the Gold is Mine. Brother Frank.
Good morning, everyone. Just a little review to commence our class this morning. These ideas probably already have been entrained in us pretty well by the fact that it comes up in our readings so often to read Haggai. But nevertheless, the thing we're trying to do is build parallel to Haggai and to see in the work that and the patterns that were going on in these days some guidelines for ourselves. So first of all, they came back out of the blessing of God. And the fact that they were even starting to build at all and had a temple site to work on was because of the calling of God and the blessing of God. And when they started to build, of course, they ran into some opposition. And carefully in the text, especially in Ezra, it is to be noted that when the foundations of the temple were laid, some of them wept and some of them shouted for joy. The ones that wept were the older members of the ecclesia who could remember the bigger plan of Solomon's temple. And although there are different views as to why they wept, I believe it was because it was so much smaller and appeared to be less significant in the eyes of the older members who could remember what the original floor plan was like. But the younger ones, a generation or two, who had never seen the temple, were just very, very happy that there was a temple, that there was this building going on. And the facts are that it's so closely associated with the opposition, it seems that the text is telling us that if there are ecclesial problems, it's not long after that before there are bigger ones. And the bigger ones, of course, were the opposition that then commenced. And the opposition rose to such a significant level that the building stopped altogether. And that wasn't all, because now God's chastening hand was there. And the normal activities which they would be engaged in were not being blessed by God. And for 15 years, it must not have been too pleasant to live under those circumstances. I can't help but imagine that their conscience would have bothered them, that they were being afflicted by just about everything that they did, in everything they did. And yet still they struggled trying to, as it says, seal their houses or panel their houses or make their own dwelling places more pleasant when God's temple lay waste. And then when Haggai and Zechariah come on the scene, again, God's intervention, providing these two prophets, the people rallied together. Now, I think we have to understand in other things that we find in Haggai that it didn't mean that everybody who was, say, holding back, now all of a sudden just was totally in favor of this and got with the work 100%, because the later statements of the prophet Haggai and some of the things that Zechariah says would indicate the people still needed to be reminded of those 15 years, and I suppose of the lingering facts in many of the minds as to whether this was really what they should be doing. So they did come back to work, but I'm not sure everybody was totally enthusiastic about that work when they got back, especially because the opposition would have still been there. They had no change in those circumstances. They just had to get back to work. And God is saying that the reasons for which you stopped are not satisfactory. And the prophets and the leaders, Zerubbabel and Joshua, led them back into work. Now that's where we look at the parallel that we're trying to draw. And yesterday, we tried to draw your attention to the fact that we need a real level of personal integrity if we're building. Because what we're trying to do is we're trying to build individual stones in our life for a temple. it's a humbling thing in that we are not any one of us building a great edifice. We're just building one stone. But that is a tremendous challenge when you think of the quality that God demands of those stones to go into his temple. And so we don't underestimate that although it seems to be a rather humble thing we're doing, yet it's a very important thing we're doing. And not only that, we are building other stones, because in our normal ecclesial activities, in our normal daily activities, we are always influencing others. We are influencing our spouse, we're influencing our children, we're influencing our parents, we're influencing our grandparents, we're influencing many others that are maybe learning the truth or will learn the truth, so that our activity can never be thought of as being totally alone. And even if we don't know of others that we're connected with, if we don't have children, we don't have parents, we don't have a spouse, we are still building in that environment. Because in the ecclesial area, anything anyone does really affects the others. And I think that's some of the sensitivity we want to try to bring out. So if we could summarize, and the value, of course, is not summarizing before we've looked at a lot of the detail, but we've got to move on. There are many cases in the Bible where we can see personal integrity. We tried to illustrate that Job was one of the best because it's condensed into chapter 31, and you can read that at your leisure, and you can see the number of things which for him were so valuable and such a lesson for us. But there are probably two summary verses for personal integrity. One is Romans chapter 14, and that is in verse 22. And we'll have a look at that one first, and then we'll go on to another one that I think is the companion passage. One of these, or both of them, would best be written out and placed in a suitable location in our house. Because although we can assent or give assent to these things, and we can acknowledge before our God and before our brothers and sisters that these are very motivating, very useful verses, yet they don't seem to come into our minds at the right time, such that we can find ourselves being condemned by these things because we didn't bring them to mind when it was needed. Romans 14, verse 22. Happy is he that condemneth not himself in that thing which he alloweth. Now that's a summary verse, I believe, about personal integrity. That when we read the Bible and we read the Bible and we listen to expositions and we expound it ourselves, we come up with a belief system of what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil. And that's what priests were to do, to make the difference between right and wrong for people. So in our training for our work that's yet to come, this is good practice to take on subjects and try to decide what is right and wrong about that subject area. But having that distinction made, happy is he that condemns not himself in that which he alloweth. So when we're looking at how we spend our time, how we give of our energy and our resources, if we find ourselves wasting it in any one endeavor in life, whatever it might be, it wouldn't be a bad idea to write that verse out and stick it right over where it's appropriate in our house. Now that's figures that come out of the Old Testament for us, where Moses, instructed by God, told the children of Israel to write these things on their doorposts, to put them as frontlets before their eyes. And he didn't say that for any other reason than knowing human nature, we need that constant reminder. Because the character of us, the substance of us, is such that we can go out of the building knowing what's right and 15 or 20 minutes later commit an error in the thing we know is right because we don't have the presence of mind. So we've got to think of every trick we can to make sure that we do not condemn ourselves in what we're allowing. The other verse is in James. And it's, as you'll see, and have seen, I'm sure, before, it is very similar. James 4, verse 17. Therefore, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. So the one is a negative, if you like. You're condemning yourself and what you allow. We should never allow ourselves to do that. That's a discipline we must maintain in life, not to allow ourselves to do something that condemns us. On the other hand, we must have sufficient discipline that we will force ourselves to do what we know has to be done and not allow ourselves to rationalize the time has not yet come or other reasons whereby we can sit back and not get the job done. So that's where personal integrity rests. Something to motivate us to do something, something to motivate us to refrain from something else. And based on where we are in our development of integrity, we will fall in somewhere between those things. It's a good feeling, brothers and sisters, when you know I'm not going to go to bed before I have prayed or before I have done my readings or before I have made my peace with my spouse. There's a discipline in your mind that says, I will not do that. You don't allow yourselves to have the feelings that maybe have been aroused during the day between a husband and a wife to when the sun sets, to just say, well, we'll carry that over in a new day. I can very well remember Brother Harry Tennant making this point, and I think it was a very wise point to make, that you never allow, if possible, the activities of the day which are negative to carry over into another day. At the end of that day, make peace if it's possible. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, the Apostle Paul just sort of summarizes this point and brings it out, that we are never without the need for this discipline. And he countenances the whole idea of discipline in the same way that you would a person running in a race to win a prize, verse 24. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 24. So the person who is running in a race to win a prize will discipline themselves to run that race. It's a good thing to allow our children, to encourage our children to be competitive in a limited way, that they might see what it takes to be best. Now, I don't believe that carrying that much farther than just to taste that is favorable. But if we never know what it takes, what discipline it takes to be best, then we'll have a hard time with some of these things where God requires that we put out an all-out effort so that every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now, they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly so fight I, not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. And I believe there's nobody exempt from that, no matter what our age is, no matter what our environment is, no matter what level we've grown to in the truth. We have to practice self-discipline and make sure that, as it says, after preaching to others, we ourselves should be a castaway. I wonder why, in many cases in the New Testament, prayer and fasting are associated. The fasting illustrating a discipline along with the prayer that comes to us in a number of different aspects in the New Testament. Just a little thought as we're going through. Now, one of the problems that I have mentioned to some of you before in other talks, I'll just go through again. This is the world we live in, and most of us, if not all of us, will know what this diagram is trying to illustrate. In society, in business administration, this is a very big thing, stress. Stress leading to ill health. It is estimated that it's about a $50 billion loss in the United States alone, annually. And that's due to employee lost time because of stress. And many of us are not feeling stress from the truth. Well, we're feeling is the stress from life. Not necessarily of our making, but necessarily there in life. And when you see a rope like that, it's what the world thinks of it, and certainly it's a good idea. It does illustrate how sometimes we feel not the solid rope we could be, but we got one strand left. And I think there's a feeling associated with that diagram that people who have actually got to a point in life where you feel like the last strand, that's all you got left, it's a very unsettling and somewhat terrifying feeling that you are about to break under the pressure. Now, brothers and sisters, if that's the way we feel, then how do we manifest this time and this energy and these resources that we need to build this temple of God? We come home at night feeling like that from work. Where's the time we're going to spend on developing the thesis that, or the work that we need for our exhortations or for our Bible class or for the instruction of our children? And these things gradually gravitate into second place, possibly much less than that. This idea of burnout, so much material is written on this today, but it's a word that comes from the age in which we live. And I believe it is directly related to the age in which we live. Such that as knowledge has been increased and men run to and fro, so the whole pressure of modern society is such that people are burning out. Not from this, not from this, but from life itself. So this talks about nurses. The same is true for people in teaching. The same is true for anybody that's in social work. Or probably anybody that, as they say, it's in a caring profession where they find they have less and less and less energy to give to anybody else until you don't care. And you have an idea that is, or a philosophy of life that's anything but what we're describing in Haggai. Now the point of bringing this up, brothers and sisters, is if we're building a temple in our bodies and we're building a temple related to others in our family, in our ecclesia, and in the people that we can convert to the truth, what energy have we got left if we're already burned out? Well, I think there are some good answers to that, and I'd just like to put this one other one on here because it is a very well-recognized fact that if you are stressed and you come home, you will influence everybody in the house. And more than likely, you will influence everybody in the ecclesia. So let me just read a couple of these. That's probably a little hard to read from where you are. It's from an article in the Harvard Business Review called The Spillover of Stress into Family Life, and these are a few paragraphs from that. In fact, what these are the testimonies, I suppose, of wives or spouses about what happened when their spouse came home. So the first one reads, "What annoys me is when he comes home tense and exhausted, he flops into a chair, turns on the TV, or else he worries and it drives me up the wall." Now I've found that there are a lot of Christadelphians who understand what that means. Not from just knowing that what that could refer to, but knowing about self. And that is what is worrying, I think, all of us, brothers and sisters, that what we really need today is total dedication, if we can, to the things of God, and we just haven't gotten much left. And the idea of burnout is really quite terrifying, because the idea of burnout came from the idea of rockets going up where they ran out of fuel and were useless. So burnout means uselessness, got into a stage of being useless. Look at the next one. Yes, his mind is often on other things. Yes, he often worries and it does disturb the family life. When he's like that, he can't stand the noise of the children. He can't stand the fact that the children are tired. In general, we have dinner together so that he can be with them. And obviously they chatter, they spill things, they tease each other, and he blows his top. He's tense and uptight. It's disturbing. I can't stand it. That's a wife talking about her husband. And what happens in the family when this husband brings home this stress having been so stressed out, all he wants to do is totally relax when he comes home. And he can't, because that's not normal family life. Or this next one, which is just a little bit different. My husband is not one of those men who vents all his frustrations on the family. One cannot reproach him for being aggressive or for beating his wife. Instead, he closes up like a shell, total closure. The time he thinks he spends here isn't spent here. And some people react that way. They come home and go to the room, close the door, don't bother me. Or come home, sit in a chair, get behind a newspaper, don't bother me. Not reading the newspaper, just trying to shield out everything else because they've had so much tension during the day they can't stand anymore. So where is the time? Where is the energy? Where are the resources to build this temple? If this is the way we're coming home from work life, then you can see that maybe we need to do some major things. I'd like to read all of these because I do believe they're somewhat different, and we're going to refer to them in some of the passages that are coming up. The next one says, it was just after the birth of the third child 8 years ago. The birth coincided with a move to another part of the country and with a complete change in job. There, I have to admit, I was completely unaware of the consequences all this had for my wife. She was overloaded with work and worries. It went on for some time, and I just wasn't aware of what was happening. Finally, she fell ill, and I had to be hospitalized. It was only then that it began to dawn on me. I was quite unconscious of everything I was doing. You know, the stress it's building up in another person just because of the stress in a spouse, to the point where the person had to be hospitalized. And we're looking at why marriages sometimes don't last. There are a lot of reasons, brothers and sisters. But this last one is one I'd really like the brethren who have to spend some of that time and that energy on feeding the flock. When negative emotions spill over, managers often express dissatisfaction with their lifestyles and complain of wanting more time for private life. But because their minds are numbed by tension, these people cannot even use their available time in a fulfilling way. Some report needing a double martini just to summon the energy to switch on the TV. Many read the newspaper not because they're interested in world events, but to escape into personal privacy. Have you ever had the experience, brethren, of going home to work on a talk where you had the time set out, and you got there, you ran out of gas? You just did not have the energy to go through the concordance and look up and do the research. You just had put the time aside, but when you got there, you fell asleep at the desk. Now, if that is the case, then all I can say is that your experience and mine is the same, because I've experienced that many times, where you're spread so thin for all the things that have to be done that when it really comes to feeding the flock, what you're feeding them is hay, old hay at that. And there's nothing really much good about hay that's 2 or 3 years old. What the flock needs is to be taken to a pasture which is full of what is needed at the time. And that takes a lot of careful attention to the ecclesia or to the family to know, first of all, what's happening, to read the situation, to know the resources, and then to match them. I've learned an awful lot, I believe, just from watching my wife cook and just see the time that she spends cooking and going through cookbooks. You'll see her sitting at the table, and she's got 4 or 5 of them out there trying to figure out what she will cook tonight. It seems to be pretty good and not trying to have the same thing night after night. But I thought, you know, that's a real lesson in what brethren should be doing with the Bible. Not just giving the same thing or following some theme that's necessarily been the talk for the last month, but looking at what is needed and getting the books out and really putting some time and energy into providing the food that's required for the flock. Luke chapter 10, and it was mentioned by our brother Peter this morning, and certainly it's reflected in the Ten Commandments, and especially in the summary of the Ten Commandments. But in Luke chapter 10, verse 27, we should love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our strength, with all our mind. And you come home and you fall asleep. Now, brothers and sisters, that's why we spend so much time on personal integrity. If you condemn yourself and that which you're allowing, it is sin. That if you're going to say, look, I can't do anything about it, that's not sufficient. What we have to do is gravitate down to what is necessary. And that is that house, job, lifestyle, everything is put on the chopping block. That we will not allow ourselves to condemn us, to condemn ourselves in that which we know is needful and carry on in that way. That if we're putting a half-hearted interest into the truth, then do something about it, brothers and sisters. And tomorrow we're going to talk about the chastening aspects of Haggai and try to put them in a modern context of how God wants to tell us this and how he does it in our life. If we look at Haggai chapter 2, verse 8, and this is jumping ahead a little, but it's essential to understand this. We're trying to develop attitudes for building in the temple. And just this little verse popped in here would seem to be almost, first of all, out of place, because he's talking about the shaking of the nations, and he's talking about a ladder house, and he's talking about things in the future. And yet he says, the silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith Yahweh of hosts. Well, I suppose we could struggle with that. I know there are a number of different opinions on that one as well, but you may notice there's a margin reference there. And it tells you to refer to 1 Chronicles 29. Now look at what you find in 1 Chronicles 29. 1 Chronicles 29, verse... Well, I guess you'd have to look at verse 10, where what David is talking about is close to the time when Solomon is going to start building the temple. And the attitude of David always seems to be one to emulate in this aspect of building. Because first of all, it occurred to him that there was something wrong, that he should be spending so much time building his paneled house and God dwelling in a tent. And seeing that inconsistency, it was in his mind, first of all, to build a better house for God. And you can see the integrity of the man, how that he wasn't prepared to live with the situation. He was going to do something about it. So he was told by Nathan that you would not be allowed to build the house, but your son would. Well, what did he do? Did he sort of back off and say, well, I guess we better wait for the next generation? No, he said, well, what can I do? If I can't build the house, what can I do? And then he went, as it says in verse 2, to prepare for the building of the house. He wasn't allowed to build it, but you know, God did give him the plan, and he gave the plan to Solomon, and he accumulated many, if not most, of the building materials. So this brother came as close as he could to doing what he wanted to do for his God. But in verse 14, who am I? What is my people that we should be able to offer so willingly after this sort? For all things come of thee, and of thine own have we given thee. For we are strangers before thee, and sojourners, as were all our fathers. Our days on the earth are as a shadow, and there is none abiding. O Yahweh our God, all this store that we have prepared to build thee an house for thine holy name cometh of thine hand and is all thine own. Now, it's this attitude of mine that you can't give God anything that's yours. All you can do is return to God what he's given you. Now, when that attitude comes through, and we've got to do a lot of work on that. I'm sure we do have to do it all the time. Because that's pretty well the difference, that people have the potential to build, but they don't have the attitude to build. So we have to work on attitude. And the attitude coming through here is, don't ever think that anything is yours. God's given it to you. Whether it's personal talents that God's given to you, whether it's wealth that God has given to you, whether it's time that God has given to you, whatever God has given it, what God wants us to cheerfully return it to him. And the idea of Haggai is not that it's great things. I mean, we've got to consider that we may not be in a situation to give anything great, but just go up to the mountain and cut some wood. Do some of the simplest tasks, but do something. Now, that's just logical strategy that comes out of the world. When they're dealing with these problems, they tell you to do very little simple things to counter the stress on the job. So if you're being interrupted all the time, if the telephone is driving you crazy, what you've got to do is you've got to find personal time. And they tell you, take a folder, make out there's something in it, put it under your arm, go walk through the plant. Just make yourself unavailable. There's simple little things. And we've got to do that in the truth. We've got to learn how to take simple little things. And I believe that everybody has to do that. We're not just talking about the brethren. The sisters have got to do something. Not just the wives. The spinsters. Not just the spinsters, but the sisters who are widows. The widowers. Everybody has got to do something. That's a survival skill in the truth. So that if the person comes to us as arranging brethren and says, look, I've got nothing to do, then it's our obligation to find something for them to do. Because you can hardly survive in the truth without contributing. And it seems to be an essential thing that all of us feel we're contributing. So it should be the lot and role of some of us to make sure that that is being carried out. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Now, these exhortations are very strong, brothers and sisters, but I must tell you, I feel them every bit as much as you do. And I do not say these things from the point of view of any great success. It's just that the impact of God's word is on us all. And when you see it, you just have to react if you've got personal integrity. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 talks about a building. It talks about the aspect of building together, as they would have had to do in the days of Haggai. And you know, you look at someone and you say, well, I don't like the way you're building. You know, I like to build a straighter wall than that. Or I don't like the way you're building. If you look at the lines on that block wall, you may see a few of the lines that aren't quite in line. Some people are perfectionists. Some people not so as a perfectionist. And it takes talent to build together. A lot of talent to build together. Now, one of the things that Christadelphians have never really managed well is how to disagree. And people seem to think that if you disagree, you're out of fellowship. And we have to learn how to disagree and how to allow for other people doing it just a little differently than we do it and having a little different view than we have. I mean, we're not talking about great variations because we have a statement of faith. And again, we have personal integrity that's the basis on which we are meeting. Is that when the brother says we're holding the meeting on the basis of the Birmingham amended statement of faith and those that meet consistently on that basis, that out of good conscience before our God and before our brothers and sisters, that's true for us. And if it's not true, we shouldn't be here. That basic integrity has to be in place. So that now when we're going to build together, that integrity will allow us to be sympathetic for others that are building a little differently than we are. So some people, yes, are building, as he says in verse 12, gold and silver and precious stones. And it's obvious. Other people are building wood and hay and stubble, and it's equally obvious. But we're all building. Even if people don't appear to be building, they're building. And the day's coming, as he says in verse 13, when what quality of work they're building will be revealed by fire. Fire is going to test that. In verse 14, if a man's work abide, which he hath built thereupon, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss. But he himself shall be saved, yet so as by fire. And then he goes on to talk about the temple of God that we're building. Now what I'd like to deal with most of all today, brothers and sisters, is our family. How are we building our families? It's close to my heart because many of you would know the whole ecclesia in Shelburne is based on that. We didn't build our hall in town. We built our hall out in the farm, 8 miles from town. It's out in the middle of the pasture. It doesn't even really blend in well with all the barns. Here's this hall out in the field all by itself. But that's because we wanted to ensure we could build our families in the truth. And that our children would have a place to go to that would not be interrupted by the world, where they could go and they could run around and they could perform the alternatives to what we've told them they can't do in town. If we look at 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 14. Now, the Word of God is very strong. It really can't be argued with on what it tells our young sisters to do. I have four young ladies in my family. I'm very interested in their welfare. And being associated with college and counseling and careers and things like that, I'm very, very aware of what happens when they get into some of these careers. The counsel of God is, through Paul to Timothy, I will, therefore, that younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. What could I say more? What could I say less? What could any of us add or diminish from what he has said? That's what God intended. Now, a person need not to feel that they have missed their calling in life if they don't marry. Because Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 7 that you can still serve the Lord. But as a general pattern, this is what we should generally say. That our guidance to the young sisters would be that they marry, bear children, guide the house. That's not what the world says. Brothers and sisters, don't default to the world. The world wants your daughters. They want to take your daughters and they want to put them in professions for which women have never worked before. They will give incentives to them. They will offer them opportunities in college that they will not offer young men. They will offer them jobs when they graduate they will not offer to young men. And those who have been watching the track record have seen whether or not that's successful. I have probably more women I report to than men at all levels in the college system at this stage. I work for a woman, the vice president is a woman, there's another woman that is a president in the system, and the whole system is changing. Well, who's guiding the house? Who's raising the children? Who is complimenting the husband? Well, there's all kinds of awkward situations. I have a situation in one college I work for where the vice president is a woman and her husband works for her, and I evaluate her husband and report to her. Believe me, they're awkward. But women are in a great degree of temptation, I believe, today to depart from the counsel that was given in the Scriptures. If you look over in Titus, these are the things that appear to me to be really critical today, brothers and sisters. I mean, I think there's an exhortation for the age, for us, for this generation, quite apart from whether it applied to other generations as much. Verse 3 of Titus 2, the older women likewise, that they may be in behavior as becometh holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers. Women as teachers of good things, that they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. And that word used for love their husbands and love their children is not agape. That's filial. And it would seem that most women feel, if they're in the older capacity, that young women just naturally know how to love their husbands and to love their children. And many of the younger women say, you don't need to teach me that. I know that. The Bible says the older women should teach the younger women how to love your husbands, how to love your children. That is a skill to be taught. We're not born with that skill. And to assume that we are, or to default to the way of the world, is one of the reasons why there's such a poor job being done on loving husbands and loving their children. In 1 Peter chapter 3, where it talks about husbands and wives, likewise, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if they obey not the word, they may also without the word be won
by the behavior of the wives. Now, I don't say these things in any sense to be humorous. I don't think in this capacity humor is well placed. I say these things out of trying to give the older, more mature women some of the ideas you ought to be telling the younger women about how to love their husbands and how to love their children. Because I think there's a lot of information that is not being communicated. First of all, I think it would be important that if husbands would take the time to tell their wives what it is that really pleases them in the relationship between a husband and a wife, so that a wife might know from the husband's reaction what to tell these young women, and not just to assume that she knows. For instance, one of the things that I find very impressive about my wife is that she compliments. There's no competition. There's no attempt to be competition. She tries to compliment. And her attempt to compliment me makes me feel like I want to compliment her. That is a reciprocal thing, I'm sure, from the husband leading as well as the wife leading. I must say, I've very much admired my wife for dedication. As you can well imagine, to raise 8 children, you have to be fairly dedicated. I don't know how much laundry she does, but I don't think I've ever seen the thing ever turned off. And I know that we've gone through quite a few of them, and probably will so for some time. I don't know how many years, but it was about 15 years straight we had diapers. And many of you sisters would know how much work is involved in that. I must say, I admire my wife for handling money well. A very important feature of our society is to be able to handle money and not to be a spendthrift and not to react oppositely, but to know that we've got to handle it in the basis of what we have and not what we'd like to have or think we have. To be able to handle the credit card properly and not to just go out and buy things because we have the capability with plastic money, only to have to face it later on. I admire that very much in my wife. My wife does not nag. She knows there's a lot of things to be done in the house. I don't care about the housekeeping. I must say that sometimes I have to fight the spiders to get into my room, but that doesn't really bother me. And I have to dust off my equipment before I get... But that's my job, I feel. I don't really worry about my wife doing that. It wouldn't be safe to turn the lights out and walk through our house at night. But those kinds of things are put in their perspective. If you're going to have 8 children, let's live in the house. Let's not make it an edifice. We're going to live in this house. And as a result, I don't nag her. She doesn't nag me. And those things are really vital to make it work well and should be communicated to young wives starting off, so that we don't have these problems that are so common today. My wife is feminine, and I admire her very much for that. I don't like to see my daughters or my wife ever in slacks. I have insisted that my children wear dresses to school. My daughters are old enough now to thank me for it. I told them, I want you to be feminine. Look feminine all your life, and be attractive to your husband. Not that you have to add anything that God didn't give you, just look like a woman and not try to be a man. And around a farm, sometimes that's difficult. There's a lot of chores where you get very dirty, and in the wintertime is very cold. So I don't insist. I just say, this is what I would like. We sit down and we do the readings. We take advantage of what the readings say to dwell on it, but we don't insist, don't demand things. My wife is very faithful. And I must say, I admire that very much in her. I don't mean just faithful as a husband is to a wife, but I know when I'm here, she's doing the readings with the children. I know she'll do that because I've ever been away, the children have always gone through the same instruction. She does the instruction for Sunday school with them. So the things that I admire in my wife are things which make me very sympathetic to her and want to compliment her. Now, brothers and sisters, that's the way we've got to learn to build, is to look at the person that's building right next to us, spouse, if need be, or a close friend, and try to compliment them, not to compete with them, but to see that if they built a little this way, then we will go a little further that way to meet them. And if they're building our way, we will back up a bit to meet them, to make sure that that house is built strong. No gaps. I must say, I also admire my wife for wearing a head covering. I think that's very important. And at the appropriate time, she does that. But you know, when you go into the Bible, there's a lot of things required of a man. And this is where I had been very impressed about the man. I don't know how good of a job I've done, but I believe that these are the responsibilities of a man. Going back to Genesis 18, although we know Sarah played a very important part in the bringing up of the children, it's of Abraham that the angel says in verse 19, I know him that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of Yahweh to do justice and judgment, that Yahweh may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. Now, I only wish I had an hour right now, because to see what Abraham did with his children, not just Isaac, but with Jacob, is to build into grandparents what they ought to be doing with their grandchildren. Now, I don't think this is for parents as much as it is for grandparents, of which there must be a lot in this room. We don't know this unless we check the chronology of the record. But if you go on to Genesis 25, where Esau and Jacob are born, if you read the chapter as it comes to us and assume it's in chronological order, then you have Abraham buried before Jacob is born. That's not right. Jacob was contemporary with Abraham for 15 years. Then when you read that Esau, as it says in verse 27, was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents, you understand why it says Jacob was a plain, meaning upright man, dwelling in tents. Where one man was out enjoying himself in the field, doing what he liked to do, another man was with Abraham, his granddad. And that can be developed into one of the most fantastic exhortations I've ever seen. One of the links is to go to Hebrews 11. And I've run out of time, but I'll, Lord willing, pick up on this again tomorrow. But just look at this Hebrews 11 passage first. Hebrews 11, verse 9. By faith he, Abraham, sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tents or tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Esau wasn't there. He was a man of the field. He was a hunter. Jacob, for 15 years, had the benefit of the wisdom of that old man. And I am sure that Abraham did what the angel said he would do. He would bring up his household after him. And he would have educated Jacob in such a way that Jacob never, ever forgot it. Tomorrow I'd like to show you why and what kind of an impact it had on his life until the day he died.